Hello, listeners who have yet to make a financial contribution to Montana Public Radio's Fall Fund Drive. Your mission, should you choose to accept, and I hope you will, is to call one of these numbers, 800-325-1565 or 243-6400, or make your pledge online at mtpr.org. I'm Cherie Newman, inviting you to support locally produced programs like The Right Question, Musician Spotlight, and Montana News by letting us know they are important to you. Unlike the challenges faced by the characters from Mission Impossible, however, we've made it really easy for you. Simply call. Oh, wait, you need time to grab a pen. So while you're doing that, I'll tell you what you're about to hear. Hamilton author Beth Hunter McHugh talking about creativity, Barbara Van Cleve sharing her opinion about the romance of the West, Joe Wilkins describing how the birth of his son ignited a firestorm of poetry, Paula McLean talking about the challenges of writing first-person historical narrative, Ken Elgunis relating the story of his encounter with a self-appointed posse in northeastern Montana, and a preview of an upcoming conversation with the award-winning New Mexico poet Carmen Jimenez Smith. Okay, now that you have your pen in your hand, here's the contact information you need to write down so you can make your pledge. 800-325-1565 or 243-6400. If you'd rather make your financial contribution online, log on to mtpr.org. Obviously, you can listen while you pledge online, but if a phone call is your preferred course of action, do it now so you don't miss what's coming up. Ready, set, pledge. What is the most important thing for you to get done during the next 20 minutes? Make a pledge of support to Montana Public Radio. Beth Hunter McHugh won the Meadowlark Award for her debut novel, The Actor. She teaches high school English in Hamilton, so she drove to Missoula on a Saturday morning last spring so we could talk about her book in our studio. It seems like the creative process has become somewhat of a marketable commodity. You can go buy books on how to be creative mm-hmm. and read blogs on how to be creative and buy magazines and sign up for workshops. And I just wonder if that's putting a lot of pressure on ourselves to be creative. How does that work for you?
I think that's very true. I've been so happy to have had this book published, and it's been great to do interviews like this and readings at bookstores. But I do think it puts pressure on me to keep creating. I think, well, I have to come up with the next book and the next thing. Otherwise, I'm no longer a creative person. But I've kind of been fighting against that a little bit. And I think you're right. I think there is pressure to be creative. But I think at the same time, there's a new conversation coming about that recognizes that we're all creative beings and that we need to embrace sort of the daily things we do. It doesn't just have to be about being an artist or a writer, that we're creative beings just by being in the world and creating the lives that we want.
Do you ever feel burdened by the expectations of calling yourself a writer or having someone else call you a writer?
I do. And I'm an introvert, and so it's been hard for me to do the publicity part of publishing a book. And I think I put pressure on myself again to think, what if I keep writing, but I never publish anything else? Am I still a writer? I'd like to think so, but I struggle with that. I do.
Good question. Yes. I read something you wrote. I'm going to quote here. The artist, the writer, the activist, they created for us what we could not create for ourselves. they said what we could not say. Is that why you write, maybe to express what you and others couldn't say at a certain moment?
Well, I think one of the reasons I wanted to write was because I was so amazed at the way certain writers, certain artists, like Ivan Doig, could capture human emotion so succinctly and cleanly and accurately on the page. And they did say things for me, but my most beloved books say things for me that I cannot express myself. And I think I thought, what if I might be able to do that? And if I could get at that ability, that would be sort of amazing. I mean, if I would be able to express something for someone else and sort of give someone that gift or be of service in that way.
What do you want people to know about this novel?
My hope is that this book won't be seen as a sad or a sorrowful story, but that it's a book that celebrates being true to yourself. And I think that was really my intention with this book, that we all struggle knowing who we are, and when we know who we are, we struggle with bringing that person fully into the world. I think we fear being accepted or rejected. So it's a book about bravery, I think, with many of the characters. Not just the father recognizing who he is and accepting who he is, but all of the characters. I think we see that with the narrator too. She's working at accepting others, but she's also working at accepting herself. So my hope is that it would be ultimately read as a hopeful story.
Yeah, I think there was a lot of hope in there. And of course, as in all good stories, the characters change.
Right.
Sometimes you have to go through something before you can know what you need to accept about yourself.
Yes.
And that's what I liked in the book, that everybody is going through a process and then they're saying, oh, this is more of who I am over here, not what I've been doing.
Right, right. It's hard once you realize, here I am over here, this is me, but over here is the person I have been and I'm comfortable in that role, right? It's hard to leave that behind, I think, and move into the self that is more accurate, that is more authentic. And you're right, it doesn't happen overnight. It's sometimes a very difficult road.
And people don't like us to change.
Right, exactly.
Because then they have to readjust.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, so much of it is that fear of how will others feel about this new me?
If becoming a part of a new, improved you includes attaining a new personal best as a sustaining member of Montana Public Radio, we've made it really easy for you. Call one of these phone numbers, 800-325-1565 or 243-6400, or pledge online at mtpr.org. Barbara Van Cleve is a photographer who lives on a ranch near Big Timber, and one of the misconceptions she often encounters when people look at her photographs is the notion of the West as a very romantic place. So I ask her about that. What do you think of the word romance as it relates to the West and your images? Go for it. Tell us what you really feel.
Well, I do think there is, quote unquote, a lot of the so-called romance of the early West. It's, you know, the concept of the single, strong-hearted cowboy on horseback who is defending all kinds of things, law and order and maidenhood and all of that. Well, I do know from the fact that I was on our guest ranch, the Dude Ranch part of our ranch, for many, many years. And I've really enjoyed that. I learned how to get over being very shy there and was exposed to so many interesting people. But I also know people, a lot of men came out because they had that little vision of themselves somewhere tucked in the back of their minds, riding out on a horse into the sunset, the whole romantic notion. And I don't know. I don't think my work is romantic. I don't mean it to be. What I mean it to be is to show the beauty, even in the midst of rain, snow, I mean, really frigid weather.
Dust, flies, a sore butt, a ravine you can't get across.
Well, take that shot called Ground Blizzard, which I made when I was 15, I think, with my dad on a hunting pack trip. I mean, we went up and we camped over there on the middle fork of Big Timber Creek. Beautiful fall evening, but it got chilly. And the next morning we woke up with about a foot and a half of snow on the sugans or bedrolls. And then broke camp and headed out because Dad said, we'll see what we can find. But then the wind came up and the clouds settled down and began to snow, and it was a wind drifting, blowing snow, a true ground blizzard. So he said, we're not going to be able to track anything, so we're just going to head home. Well, let me tell you, it was cold and miserable, but that photograph I did, one photograph, because growing up on a ranch, I wasn't going to waste money taking a bunch of pictures. I would just take one of each scene that I saw. And I don't know, it's just so vivid in my mind. I don't think of it as romantic, but some people see it as having a romantic quality. Well, everybody approaches a work of art in a different way. And they bring to it what they want to bring to it. And I am producing what I want to produce.
That's sort of how I feel about The Right Question. It's my art, and I get to produce what I want to produce, which is such an honor for me. Thank you for the financial support that makes The Right Question possible. Joe Wilkins was born and raised in Montana. He lives in Oregon now, but he travels through every so often. And I talked to him last summer, just after his latest poetry collection, When We Were Birds, was published. This collection includes a series of poems written to your son, mm-hmm. both before and after he was born. Yeah. How did you get started with that?
Yeah. When we were expecting, my wife was doing all this important biological work, and I sort of felt left out in some ways. You know, I thought like, oh, I need to make sure I'm involved as much as I can be. And I was trying to do that in many of the usual ways, but as a writer, one of the other ways was trying to reckon with this new thing in our lives on the page. And so I started doing that, and it became kind of almost a journal. I would try to write one a day. And there's many of those that didn't make it into the book, many of those notes. Wherever we were, wherever my thoughts were going, whatever was happening, is kind of a record for him and to him. And then after Walter was born, our son, there was just no other thing to write about. You know, I'm always writing about what I'm seeing, what matters to me, what's important to me, what I can't quite figure out. And becoming a father, becoming a parent, having this new life in your home is something really to reckon with and to try to figure out, and something that I don't think I'll ever fully figure out, but writing helps me do that. It helps me understand, and it helps me see us from a distance and see us up close, and so I really value it for that.
The first poem in the collection also gives the book its title, so let's hear that one.
Yeah. So this is called My Son Asks for the Story About When We Were Birds. When we were birds, we veered and wheeled. We flapped and looped. It's true, we flew. When we were birds, we dined on tiny silver fish in the watery hearts of flowers. When we were birds, we sistered the dragonfly, brothered the nightwise bat, and sometimes when we were birds, we rose as high as we could go, light, cold, and strange. And when we opened our beaked mouths, sundown poured like wine down our throats. When we were birds, we worshiped trees, rivers, mountains, sage knots, rain, gizzard rocks, grub-shot dung piles, and like all good beasts and wise green things, the mothering sun. We had many gods when we were birds, and each in her own way was good to us, even winter fog, which found us huddling in salal or silk tassel, singing low sweet songs and closing our blood-rich eyes and sleeping the troubled sleep of birds. Yes, even when we were birds, we were sometimes troubled and tired, sad for no reason, and so pretended we were not birds, and fell like stones, the earth hurtling up to meet us, our trussed bones readying to be shattered, our unusually large hearts pounding for nothing. Yet at the last minute we would flap and lift, and as we flew shudderingly away, we told ourselves that this falling we would remember. We thought we would always be birds. We didn't know. We didn't know we could love one another with such ferocity that we should.
Did that come from an actual question you got from your son?
Yeah. He asked me to tell that story one night. I try to tell the kids a story at night before bed, and often they want a story about something I did when I was a boy, you know, when I made bad choices or when I got in trouble or things like that. And that night, Walter was sort of half asleep, half awake, and he was in bed, sort of eyes just about to drift. And he asked for a story, and so I said, "What kind of story?" And we'd been talking for a while. And finally he said, "Tell me the story about when we were birds." And immediately I just thought, oh my goodness, how can I possibly tell that story? But I have to tell that story. And I don't remember exactly what story I told that night, but it was a story trying to make sense, you know, just about when we were birds. And the next morning, immediately, I started sort of rewriting it and working it and shaping it into this poem.
You're listening to Snippets of the Right Question from past programs. I'm Cherie Newman, inviting you to support The Right Question by making a contribution during this fund drive. It's quick and easy. Call 800-325-1565 or 243-6400. You can pledge online while you listen at mtpr.org. You'll also find a link to The Right Questions podcast and Facebook and Twitter pages there. Paula McLean was just on the program last week, but I really don't think it's too soon for a reprise. She was so much fun to talk with. We chatted mostly about her novels, Circling the Sun and The Paris Wife, in which she fictionalized actual people. Not such an easy thing to do. You have taken a real person and written a novel in her voice.
Yes.
And for anybody who's not a writer, writing in first person is very confining. And so you've confined yourself to the first person voice.
Yes.
And then you've also confined yourself to...
to historical period and all those facts
right.
on record. And yeah, it's a challenge that I like. And I've done it before. So the first historical novel that I did was called The Paris Wife. And it was about Ernest Hemingway's first marriage to Hadley Richardson and their time in Paris in the 1920s when they were sort of part of a golden circle of expats, including F. Scott Fitzgerald and Zelda and Gertrude Stein and
wonderful
Ezra Pound.
Book. Very wonderful book.
Thank you. But I kind of stumbled onto that as an idea. It never occurred to me to write historical fiction until I happened upon Hemingway's memoir, A Movable Feast, and became fascinated by that part of his life and by this relationship and how romantic it was and how tragic a love story it was. And so she became my vehicle for entering the story. And the fact that I found her voice, that I started to write that book from the first person, was never a rational decision. you know? She was my ticket to 1920s Paris to get close to him and that whole circle. And I never really thought about what I was doing. Some people have said I've invented a genre of whatever you would call it, fictional memoir or biographical fiction. I didn't invent anything, but I think it is that idea of choosing to write from the first person about a real life historical figure. Maybe that's what they're talking about.
Well, you had to be somewhat embodied writing as if this were actually your memoir. And your first book was a memoir. And your second book was memoir-ish, even though it was...
I think you've hit on something. It probably is my sweet spot as a writer to write in a very immersed way and also in a very voice-driven way. So when I happened upon this idea to write, essentially to write a movable feast from Hadley Richardson's point of view, her voice, that was the secret sauce. That was the whole ball of wax. Once it occurred to me that to write this book from her point of view, her voice was everything. Getting her voice was, that was the magic.
And it was the magic, because when I read that book, I thought, the voice is so clear and so strong and so authentic. That's what makes the book remarkable.
Thank you. I think of it as sort of more of an actor's trick.
Mm-hmm.
Getting into the skull of a character and looking through their eyes, their vantage point, their point of view, is essentially how I read as a kid, too. I wanted to disappear. I wanted all those boundaries to blur and to fall into a world and not wake up at all. And so that's what I like as a writer. I want a completely immersive experience. I had never been to Paris when I took on this idea. I had never been to Africa when I decided to write about Africa. And so that's part of what I love, is getting completely lost in my research until I disappear into this world. Writing from a first person, too, I think allows me to descend more completely into a character, right?
Because you're not looking at the story from the outside in.
I don't want to be objective. I don't even want to try to be objective, right? Mm-hmm. I want to believe for the time that I'm writing the book that I'm Beryl Markham. I don't want those barriers to knowledge or experience. I want to get to the bottom of her.
Reading as a way to become totally immersed in another world is something I hadn't thought about for a long time until I talked with Paula. But not only did I do it as a child and a young adult, I'm still doing it. Some people do it with TV or YouTube. I do it with books and radio. Ken Ilgunis is a particular kind of author. He's a young man who likes to go on adventures, and he's found out that book contracts can partially support that kind of lifestyle, just as long as he lives fairly simply. His new book is titled Trespassing Across America, and in it he details his walk from the tar sands of Alberta to the Gulf Coast of Texas. He followed the proposed route of the Keystone XL pipeline. Here's a snippet of our conversation about his trek through Montana.
In Canada, I was trespassing and I talked to folks about it. It just wasn't a big deal. But once I crossed the border into Montana, pretty much every day I got called crazy, and people prophesized that I was going to get shot that very day. So it was a slightly different mentality. But overall, really nothing but kindness.
What about the day where the three guys came and woke you up?
You're speaking of the posse.
Yes.
Yeah. So I forget where exactly I was in the state at that point. But I was walking some grasslands, and it was getting to be that time of evening where I wanted to set up my tent for the night. And I was also out of water, so I walked up to this rancher's home, and this young man was out there, and he had a pistol with a barrel that was so long, like right around his hip. And I knew that he must have heard from someone else that I was in the area, because there's just no way you would carry a gun like that around you, you know, when you're doing just general ranching duties. And he was very nervous when I asked him for water. And normally I'd just lay on the charm as best I could. And that often put people at ease, but it just wasn't working with this guy. And I just asked, where can I camp? And he just said, oh, down the road, wherever you want, just to, you know, get me away from his property. So I set up my tent, a mile or so down the road next to this creek on some grassland. And in the morning, I wake up to a sheriff's voice. He says, good morning, this is the sheriff. And I get out of my tent, and I'm surrounded by three guys. At least one of them is armed. Presumably all of them were. And they just all had steely glares. at that point, I was just playing the best card I had, which was just like this, please don't shoot me, self-deprecating submission. And I, was just trying to make fun of myself. They're like, we just came out here to make sure you weren't crazy. And I was like, you got to be crazy to be doing something like this. And one of the older gentlemen kept saying, what you're doing, it's strange. It's strange. No one comes walking out here. What you're doing, it's strange. He kept saying that. And I was like standing innocently next to my tent, but he spoke as if I was like oiling myself up for a satanic ritual or something. And he said, just don't trespass. And I think I probably obeyed that for about 10 minutes.
Lots of adventure stories in Ken's book, Trespassing Across America. I want to leave you with a preview of a conversation I had last week with an award-winning poet from New Mexico, Carmen Jimenez Smith. Even though all poetry is compressed narrative, your poems somehow compressed it even farther. Is that something that you really have to work at?
I think it's something that I feel compelled to do. I'm always thinking about how can this be tighter, because it's about the music. It's about arriving at a kind of sublime sound in which you're transported through the sound, and they're just grammatical constructions that are bulky and they remind us of thinking. And I like language that reminds us of feeling what we think.
That idea of being transported through sound, that's exactly what Montana Public Radio aims for in every broadcasting moment. We want to transport you into other realities through sound. The Right Question is here every Thursday evening at 7 o'clock to support your desire to know more about the creative process of writing and authors and their perspective about the world we all live in. In return, we ask for your financial support. Don't make our mission to pay for all the equipment and people necessary to bring you public radio impossible. Accept your mission to pledge right now and call 243-6400 or 800-325-1565. Or grab your computer, tablet, or phone and log on to mtpr.org, where you can pledge online. And thank you. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you, as always, a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions. See you next Thursday.